virtual non-existence, before redirecting the vector thrust, which was normally used to control landings and takeoffs. In a maneuver no missile could imitate, the flitter shot 90 degrees away from its previous position. Blinded by the burning phosphorus and the floating metallic cloud, the missile's onboard systems did the only logical thing. The sound of the warhead detonation reverberated off the Glen's walls as it spewed forth its deadly cargo harmlessly into the soft green grass and bracken. LaPole closed her eyes and tilted her head back into the padded pilot seat, releasing a long, slow breath. Mary reached across and placed a reassuring hand on the Merc's arm.
"Damn good flying, Captain."
A gurgling laugh escaped LaPole's lips.
"Let's never do that again, shall we?"
Mary joined in the tension-releasing laugh.
"Agreed."
LaPole reopened her eyes and rolled her shoulders.
"What say we get our asses to the lodge? I need a drink." "First round's on me," said Mary,
as she killed the still-sounding missile alarm. For a brief second, the cockpit descended into grateful silence, before the missile alarm once more screeched its warning. Mary interrogated the system, realizing too late the oncoming danger, which caused the blood to drain from her face as she looked into LaPole's questioning eyes.
"I'm sorry,"
was all Mary had time to blurt out as death overtook her. The second Hexshaw Tall 9 detonated its warhead from a distance of less than 10 yards, directly above the stationary craft, while still traveling at a little over Mach 2. The effect was akin to firing a shotgun at a block of cheese at point-blank range. 1,500 hardened carbon fragments flashed through the skin of the flitter, as if its armor was nothing, slicing through controls, electronics, flight surfaces, fuel and oxygen tanks, and the soft, yielding flesh and bone of the flitter's precious human cargo. For the 42 souls aboard, it was over in an instant. If the multitude of flying, razor-sharp fragments did not kill them, then the expanding fireball of superheated hydrogen fuel did. Ironically, the only piece of the flitter to remain intact after the missile's impact was the defensive pod, within which the search and rescue transponder was located. When the transponder failed to register input from the flitter's flight control computers, it activated its downed aircraft procedure. The ghostly signal began transmitting on the search and rescue frequency, telling the world where to find the remains of its passengers and crew. An attention tone caused the tactical officer of the Great Claw to check his trivy, and the blinking icon caused his lizard-like mouth to drop open in satisfaction.
"The escaping flitter has been destroyed, Commander."
Gial waved a hand dismissively at the news. He had bigger fish to catch, and the chase of the fleeing merchantman was moving the cruiser invariably westward and closer to the ongoing battle with the few human mercenary ships which had joined the fight. The urgent, repeated pinging of the search and rescue beacon echoed in the silence of the comms bunker. Katrien Quant sat stock still in her seat, vision blurring as tears filled the mercenary veteran's eyes before gently rolling down her cheeks. Quant sat there for a long moment, her mind filled with the memories of running, laughing children as they pretended to be their parents, marching in ludicrous fashion, all out of step, and producing some of the sloppiest salutes she had ever seen. Sorrow was slowly replaced by a deep, burning hatred. A hatred that would stoke the fires of revenge. One final time, Quant checked that the Salamanca had received her feed, before reaching up and slowly disconnecting her pinplants. Standing, she walked across to an ordinary-looking console and keyed in a seemingly random but complex series of characters. A bulbous optical scanner extended on its pencil-thin stock with a small whirring sound. When it had locked in place, Quant pressed her left eye against the scanner, which read the pattern of rods and cones laid out on her retina. Happy with her identity, a flat metal cover popped open at the side of the console to reveal a fat red button. Without hesitation, Quant pressed down on it so hard the blood was forced from her finger. On each of the Trivi displays in the comms bunker, a clock began to count backward from 5 minutes. From the computer memory core came a flash of light and a puff of smoke as the drives fried. When the timer reached zero, the C6 explosives rigged on each piece of sensitive equipment would detonate, completely trashing the bunker and ensuring nobody would learn the secrets of the Scorpions. Quant ignored the acrid cloud permeating the bunker from the smoking computer drives as she strode for the door, pausing to retrieve her Gal 12 assault rifle from the weapons rack. Like any professional soldier, she had a go-pack stashed under her bed, with a minimum of spare clothes, food, water, and ammo. Without a backward glance, she shouldered the rifle and headed up the stairs, her face blank and expressionless. Somebody had just made a blood enemy of Catrian Quant. And whomever that person was, it had become Quant's sole purpose in life to end them.
Oh, dear God, no.
The moaning statement dragged Kate Priceman's attention from her tactical display and the Hexshaw cruiser that was rapidly closing to within range to launch its small craft. Kate's eyes found the source of the sound, and the rebuke that had been forming in her throat died as she saw the haunted look on Jacobsthal's face.
Report, Mr. Jacobsthal.
The bridge officer cleared his throat loudly, opened his mouth to speak, and nothing came out. Shaking his head, he squared his shoulders and tried again.
The flitter with the families on board has been shot down. The SNR beacon indicates no survivors.
Kate felt like someone had slapped her across the face. Her sense of time and reality escaped her as she tried to grasp what Jacobsthal had said. Her conscious mind rebelled against it.
You just didn't kill civilians. That was wrong. Just plain wrong.
Then, like a stretched elastic band snapping back into place, she returned to the here and now.
Put it away, Kate, she told herself. There's no time to mourn. For now. We must concentrate on getting out of here alive. And to do that, I need to lead by example.
Kate took a breath and forced herself to be calm. When she spoke, her tone remained even and almost unwavering as she addressed the entire bridge.
Listen up, people. Put what's just happened in a box and close the lid. We have the bastards closing on us. And they have no idea what they have bitten off. So let's keep them fat and happy until we can kick them right on their Hexshaw balls.
Range to target,
demanded Gial.
300 miles, Commander, replied the tactical officer,
concentration etched on his face as his gaze fixed on the radar. Something had appeared momentarily before disappearing amid the hundreds of geostationary satellites and hovering near space stations that seemed to infest its orbit. He dismissed the momentary image as a partial reflection, a sensor ghost.
We have matched speed and course with the merchantman, Commander. Permission to launch small craft.
Launch,
ordered Gial, his attention already turning to the communications officer.
Order that bucket of bolts to maintain its course. reduce speed, and prepare to be boarded.
At once, Commander!
They're ordering us to slow and prepare to be boarded, Captain, said Jacob Stahl.
I'll give them prepare to be boarded, muttered Kate,
as she activated her link to Alistair Sinclair.
Alistair, keep your men on their toes. The Hexshaw have a couple of boarding parties on the way over, and you might need to take care of any that we miss.
In the familiar surroundings of his Mark 8 Casper, with two more Caspers from 3rd Platoon covering his right and left flanks, Alistair stood positioned on Deck 2 aft. The remainder of 3rd Platoon and 1st Platoon Zulu were spreading themselves out at tactical locations throughout the Salamanca, ready to respond to any penetration of the hull. The rest of Alistair's command were already in lightweight vacuum suits, standing by to assist the freighter's crew with damage control. Alistair automatically checked his fuel and ammo levels before replying to Kate. All topped off and good to go.
We're ready to give them a warm welcome.
Kate terminated the link to Alistair before she blurted out the ghastly truth that was burning on her lips.
Not now, Kate. Later, if we survive the shit.
Light them up, Mr. Jacob Stahl.
A command flashed from the South African's pen plant, triggering the Salamanca's search radar. The twin radars mounted on the bow and the stern of the freighter went from passive standby mode to active tracking, filling the space around the Salamanca with enough electromagnetic energy to cook anything made of flesh and bone that was not protected by thick shielding. In each small craft's cockpit, radiation alarms went berserk as the flood of searching energy passed easily through the craft's thin skin, irradiating every living thing on board. In Jacob Stahl's Tri-V display, the Great Claw went from a shadowy return to a finely detailed image, while the two small craft carrying the boarding party were lit up like deer in the headlights of a moving vehicle. With no input from Jacob Stahl, the Salamanca's fire control computers assigned an equal number of railguns to each of the two targets. On the hull of the outwardly defenseless freighter, servos whined as turrets swung to the correct bearing and elevation. The targeting reticle around each small craft went from amber to green, and Jacob Stahl gleefully gave the release to fire. In the blink of an eye, each of the assigned railguns spat forth two baseball-sized projectiles. Each projectile left the gun's muzzle with an energy equivalent to 50 megajoules, or roughly the kinetic energy of a 5-ton school bus traveling at 316 miles per hour. They flashed across the gap between the Salamanca and the small craft faster than any creature made of flesh or bone could possibly hope to react. The first railgun round hit the small craft and barely slowed at the impact. For the shuttle, its pilot, and the dozen Hexshaw soldiers eagerly awaiting the chance to kill some humans, the fight was over before they even had a chance to realize they were in one. When the second railgun round arrived, it struck the still-expanding gas and random pieces of solid debris, immolating any piece it struck as it transferred its kinetic energy into heat and light. To the casual observer, it was as if both small craft had simply exploded of their own accord. Kate slammed her finger down on a key on her armrest, which sent a klaxon blast reverberating throughout the ship, a warning to its crew to stand by for radical maneuvers. She hoped that the sudden demise of the Hexshaw's boarding party and an unexpected course change by the merchantman would be enough to buy her the time to get away from the avenging Hexshaw's missile batteries. A desperate gamble, but she could see no alternative.
Mr. Horak!
Whatever instruction Kate was about to give to her helmsman was stayed, as three beams of coherent light struck the Hexshaw cruiser amidships, literally cutting it in half as the concentrated fire of megawatt output lasers sliced through the cruiser's armor like a hot knife through butter. The two, now distinct pieces of the cruiser, tumbled away, bleeding air and debris out of control, no longer a threat to Kate or the Salamanca.
"Incoming hail, Captain," said a still-shocked Jacobsthal.
Kate accepted the hail, and her surprise was complete as the face of a smiling, surprisingly young human male filled the trivy.
"Looks like you needed a hand there."
Kate recovered quickly, stilling her features to present the face of a captain who had everything under control.
"Thanks for the assist. And you are?"
Excuse my impoliteness," the man said. "Jim Cartwright, commander of the Bucephalus, colonel and owner of Cartwright's Cavaliers. At your service, ma'am."
"Kate Priceman of the Salamanca, currently carrying a contingent of Sinclair Scorpions."
Cartwright's left eyebrow rose as his interest was piqued.
"And your destination?"
Kate gave an easy chuckle.
"Somewhere way the hell away from here, where we can give these assholes some payback."
"Now that, Captain Priceman, I can definitely help you with. Have you ever been to New Warsaw?" Chapter 5 Council of War. The gentle pricking of his pinplants brought Alastair Sinclair out of his morbid reverie. The trivy paused its playback of the final transmission the Salamanca had received before Bucephalus had latched onto the merchantman and then taken it from the war zone. Alastair's emotionless eyes soaked in every minuscule feature of his enemy. In the display, the motionless face of the Vitanho General Pipo, her rodent-like face with its obligatory darkened goggles to protect her light-sensitive eyes. It may have been a Hexha missile that downed Lapole's flyer. However, it was Pipo and the Mercenary Guild who had orchestrated the attack.
"Go for Sinclair," he said gruffly, allowing his heavy eyelids to close.
Pipo's face burned deep into his psyche.
"We've entered the new Warsaw system, Alastair. Would you like to join me on the bridge?"
asked Kate Priceman. An edge of nervousness was evident in her tone, as she knew the news of the deaths of his daughter-in-law and his grandchildren had hit the man hard. Harder than Kate would ever have expected.
"I'll be up momentarily," replied Alastair,
closing the link without another word. A concerned frown creased Kate's forehead. She had barely seen or spoken to her nephew after she had broken the news of the fate of the flyer. Alastair had received the news with barely a twitch of a facial muscle. He had given her a polite thank you before excusing himself and returning to the cabin set aside for him. As was expected of Alastair, as the commanding officer, he had called on each trooper who had suffered a loss after the shooting of Lapole's flyer, and told them, personally, of the grief he shared. 9 times the door to Alastair's bunk opened and closed, and with every entrance and exit, the sense of loss spread, for every platoon had a member who had lost someone. The empathy the troopers felt for their comrades became something else during the 170-hour trip to New Warsaw. Something ugly. Being attached to the hull of the Bucephalus had meant that Kate had been unable to extend the gravity deck, which was the norm for hyperspace flights. So the crew and passengers of the Salamanca had spent the entire trip in zero gravity. Kate had fully expected the lack of gravity to restrict the activities of the Scorpion troopers. In fact, the opposite was true. On the direction of Alastair, Tim Buchanan had liaised with Horak, who double-hatted as Kate's first officer, organizing seemingly never-ending drills. Everything from section-level infiltration drills, where one section would be tasked to enter covertly a specific section of the ship and recover an object,
while an enemy force comprising a platoon or more attempted to foil their attempts. The drills went as far as full-on company-sized boarding actions, which caused merry hell in routine ship operations. When Kate had tactfully approached Alistair with a request to scale back the drills, he had pointed out that while the troopers were kept busy doing seemingly needless training, it gave them little opportunity to brood on recent events. Faced with the choice of physically exhausted troopers gratefully retiring to their makeshift bunks for sleep when given the chance to, or 7 days with bored troopers hell-bent on vengeance, Kate opted for the drills. Now, though, with entry into the new Warsaw system, the Salamanca had disconnected from Bucephalus and was navigating freely. Or as freely as it could. Jacobsthal was reporting that they were under constant lock by numerous fire control radars. The Wing 2 SARS took their security seriously.
"Will you look at the size of that thing?"
commented Horak. With a flick of a lower hand, the Pendal flung an image of their destination, Prime Base, across the main bridge trivy, just as Alistair Sinclair entered the bridge. The sight of the massive construct caused him to misjudge his reaching for the handhold that would have swung him neatly into his chair. Instead, he continued his zero-G flight until stopped ungracefully by the rear of Kate's seat. Kate let out a small chortle, while the remainder of the bridge crew feigned ignorance at his clumsiness. For his part, Alistair made the best of a bad entrance, pivoting on the ship captain's headrest and slipping his feet through the floor restraints to hold himself in place, while he, too, took in the sight of the massive space station. Space tends to cause the uninitiated to misjudge the true perspective of objects. And sitting at one of the Lagrange points of the planet that rotated slowly beyond it, someone viewing it from a distance could find it hard to gauge its size. That would be until you spied the flickering minnows that seemed to hover in an ever-moving cloud around it. These minnows were the cruisers and destroyers that had secured the Winged Hussars its deserved reputation as one of the galaxy's premier space-fighting forces, dwarfed by a space habitat that was miles on a side. Horak busily tapped away at his console, 4 limbs entering and retrieving data quicker than any human without pinplants could ever hope to. In the trivy, sections of Prime Base were highlighted one after another. The Pendal spoke with a sense of approval.
"It looks like a mix of modern Galactic Union technology and something much older."
"Prime Base is hailing us, Captain."
"Put it up, Mr. Jacobsthal," ordered Kate.
The imposing image of the space station disappeared, to be replaced with a pair of ruby-red compound eyes, which stood out like laser points from the iridescent blue chitin, which covered the entire head and body of the Min Sha. The hairs on the back of Alistair's neck stood bolt upright, and he had to physically restrain himself from reaching for the laser pistol, which sat snugly in its holster on his right leg. Alistair had no love for the Min Sha, either as individuals or as a race. On his very first mission as a trooper in the Scorpions, an 18-year-old Alistair had been forced to watch helplessly as his squad mates had been sliced into small pieces by Min Sha high-intensity lasers, like a human would carve up a roast for Sunday dinner. The screams of the troopers trapped inside their caspers was the theme of many of Alistair's recurring dreams. Mentally shrugging off the image, he returned to the present, where Kate opened her mouth to introduce herself, and the Min Sha spoke abruptly, leaving Kate's jaw flapping in midair.
"Salamanca, you are to cease all active probing immediately, or you will be fired upon."
Kate nodded to Horak, who complied with her unspoken order. If there was one thing that humans had learned about the Min Sha, is that they never bluffed. The entire concept appeared alien to them. If they said they were going to do something, then you could bet the house on it that they would. In the trivy, the mantis-like head twisted to one side on its stick-thin, elongated neck, light glinting off the blue chitin as it appeared to acknowledge some unseen speaker.
Colonel Sinclair, I am Major Kratlik of the Winged Hussars Marine Element, and I will be your escort during your time among the Winged Hussars. You are to travel via shuttle to Landing Bay 6, where I will meet you.
And with that, the transmission was abruptly terminated.
Well, I see the Minsha reputation as happy-go-lucky hosts is well-deserved,
stage whispered Jacob Thal, with a lopsided grin. His comment brought a grin to everyone else's faces, even Alistair's. Moment of levity over, Borak set them on a course to follow the beacon, while Alistair slipped once more into silence as he contemplated his and his troopers' next move. For the moment, those with him were safe. However, his thoughts strayed unbidden to his eldest son, Charlie, and the two platoons of troopers that were on their way to Galax. Without a conscious thought, his pinplants accessed the ship's internal chronometer. Set to standard Galactic Union time, the Union's equivalent to Earth's Greenwich Mean Time, was used as the standard time throughout the Union on all ships registered with a merchant guild. Alistair briefly did the math and correlated that with the travel arrangements for Charlie and his troopers. If they were still on schedule, they should be arriving at Galax sometime tomorrow. Alistair's coded warning, however, having to be carried from Stargate to Stargate by any ship headed in the right direction, would arrive at the whim of the shipping schedule. Alistair could only hope it arrived in time.
Happy birthday, son. Love, Dad.
The message hung solemnly in midair, and the hustle and bustle of the thronging bar, which was the heart of Tal Station, receded as if someone had placed a large noise-canceling bubble around the stock-still form of Charlie Sinclair.
"Everything okay, Major?"
asked Torrey MacDonald. Torrey had been a merc long enough to recognize when something wasn't right. She had joined the Scorpions as a snot-nosed trooper 17 years before, rising to the rank of sergeant, where she had moaned about how every officer she encountered had a baby face which had never seen a razor, and who had to be led around by the hand. That was before Alistair Sinclair had offered her the chance to join the ranks of the know-it-all officer types. As Lieutenant Torrey MacDonald, she had made it her mission in life to be the best officer she could be. And if the countless offers she had received to leave the Scorpions and sign up with other merc companies were a judge of her competency, she had achieved that aim. Still, it was Alistair Sinclair who had made her an officer, and loyalty and respect was something too hard to come by in the modern world for her to just up sticks and abandon her troopers for what might or might not be greener pastures.
"Heads up,"
she said in a voice loud enough to carry just as far as the other two tan-uniformed troopers sitting at the table. Sergeant Angus Deacon casually dropped a hand below table level, until it rested gently on the grip of his ever-present Steyr 880 10mm caseless machine pistol. With his opposite leg, he spun himself ever so slightly in his seat, clearing the weapon of the table and giving himself a clean draw if he needed to utilize the lethal little compact. His eyes calmly scanned the melting pot of aliens on the bar for any subtle sign of a threat. A group of knuckle-dragging Javul grunted and drank some purple concoction that was an affront to any race with decent sensory organs. Another table was virtually overflowing with hairy-ass king, 6-foot-tall gorilla analogs with razor-sharp teeth and small beady eyes. Deacon automatically dismissed them as a threat. For though Kaking looked scary as shit, they didn't have the mindset to be mercs. Nature had a cruel sense of humor. Deacon continued his threat assessment, his gaze flicking from table to table, never resting long enough on one group to arouse suspicion. While all the time he carried on his mundane conversation with a fourth Scorpion trooper, Second Lieutenant Stacy Kamala. Kamala may only have been a newly promoted second lieutenant, but it was a long-standing tradition in the Scorpions to promote from within its ranks. And though some other Merc units insisted that their officer corps be selected from outside the company to discourage patronage, the Scorpions took the view that you would fight better and harder for those you considered friends, if not family. It also meant that in situations like the group of Scorpions found themselves now, Tori, utilizing only a minimum of words, could alert her troopers to a potential threat, confident in the fact that after years together, she knew exactly how they would react. Seeing Deacon align one way, Kamala automatically aligned in the opposite direction. Raising her glass, she let out a gurgling laugh, and her head fell back while she hugged her ribs. To those in the crowded bar around her, it appeared like a normal human reaction to what must have been a hilarious joke. The laughter masked the movement of her free hand, which tucked up into her armpit to where her PS6 hung in its shoulder holster. Mean and ugly, the PS6 was jokingly referred to as the People Stopper. Made only in .30 caliber, the magazine was mounted along the top of the heavy pistol, which allowed it to hold 20 mercury-tipped rounds. A single well-placed round from a PS6 would stop a Tortantula in its tracks at close range. A less hardy race would find themselves with a hole the size of a watermelon as an exit wound. And woe betide anyone standing behind the target, because they were more likely than not to suffer a fatal injury as the slug of mercury entered their bodies without slowing perceptibly. Yeah. If you wanted to put a target down so it didn't get back up again, the People Stopper was the weapon of choice. Like Deacon, Kamala continued the mundane conversation while searching the thronging mass of alien clientele for threats. Satisfied her troopers were now on alert, Tori spared a fleeting glance at her boss. Charlie's features had formed themselves into what Tori normally described as his "it's all gone wrong" face. Lips pursed, eyebrows scrunched down, causing worry lines to cover his forehead. Head bowed, eyes trying to bore holes into the floor.
"Yeah, something has gone pear-shaped," thought Tori.
And not for the first time on this contract.
"We should have arrived on Galax by now, instead of being stuck in this hunk of junk floating around a barren planet because some merchant ship is running late. We're still one jump away from our destination, and the more time wasted getting to Galax, the more the situation could have changed, making any intelligence Captain Buchanan had passed as much use as a sieve in a water-collecting contest. Meanwhile, all our gear is stacked in temporary storage with a couple of troopers keeping guard on it, while the remainder loaf around the entire floor of the hotel Charlie was forced to rent."
Tori hated when the Scorpions had to rely on a third party to arrange transport, because it invariably went wrong somehow. Charlie's head came up, and instead of the usual flurry of quick battle orders Tori would have expected to receive over her pinplants, her boss shuffled closer to her, cupping his hand over his mouth so no one could see his lips as he whispered into her ear.
"Assume every electronic means is compromised. All messages are passed by word of mouth only, and are done so face to face. Trust no one who is not wearing this uniform, and that you personally know. Double the guard on our gear and storage, and I want someone with eyes on the gear, not just standing outside the door. Post armed guards at the hotel. I want our floor turned into a fortress, as of yesterday.
Send the runners out in pairs to locate any of our troopers not at the hotel, and get them back there ASAP. We're reneging on the contract, and heading home.
As Charlie reeled off his orders, a deepening sense of confusion filled Tori. The veteran could feel the blood slowly draining from her face. When Charlie finished speaking, she turned her head to look into his steady, unblinking eyes.
"What the hell is going on, sir?"
In all the years that Tori had known Charlie Sinclair, she had never known him to hesitate before he answered her. Now he hesitated, and that hesitation was enough to send a shiver down Tori's spine. A commotion by the bar rapidly became a roar of noise, as a dozen races shouted to be heard. Tori's eyes fixed on the trivee as it projected an image of a planet she could hardly fail to recognize. Earth. The image split in half as the whiskered, goggle-covered face of Vitano General Pipo, master technician and legend of the Mercenary Guild, began talking. The bar fell into a stunned silence as each race's individual translator converted Pipo's words into their respective tongue. Tori was struggling to comprehend what she was seeing and hearing. Earth invaded. High orbit held by alien warships. All human mercenary leaders to hand themselves over for trial on Capital Planet. Human mercenary companies to be subsumed by the Mercenary Guild. And did she hear that damn rodent correctly? Earth itself to be controlled directly by the Mercenary Guild?
"I think we might have just gone to war," said Charlie quietly.
Chapter 6 The Mission. Alexis Cromwell considered the man sitting opposite her. Solidly built under an impeccable tan uniform. Oak leaves designating him a colonel glinted on the collar. A golden scorpion encircled in a ring of equally bright gold sat on his right breast. A name tag, Sinclair A, on the left.
"This, then, was Alastair Sinclair,"
thought Alexis. The man whom all their plans to upset the stranglehold of the Mercenary Guild rested upon. The man Alexis wanted to get the measure of. In the 5 days Sinclair had been on Prime Base, he had not ventured from his assigned quarters except to attend the two meetings called by the Four Horsemen to hammer out a course of action. A course of action which had ended with Jim Cartwright declaring that with enough Ragnar, along with a promise of fresh reinforcements by Nigel Shirazi, that fighting and defeating the combined forces of General Pipo was actually a viable option. The only fly in Jim's plan was that he knew where to find the Ragnar, but the original power sources the Dustmen had equipped them with were missing. Alastair Sinclair had stepped forward and informed the gathered group of mercs that he knew of a place where he could secure the required power sources. Many of the mercs present had doubted Sinclair's claim. However, they didn't have any choice but to let the Scorpion's commander take on the mission. Clearing her throat to speak, Alexis was forestalled by the large, open-palmed hand of Alastair.
"Ms. Cromwell."
"Please, Colonel Sinclair, call me Alexis,"
Alexis interjected with her best winning smile. Alastair pursed his lips for a moment, as if considering ignoring her attempted platitude.
"Alexis,"
Alastair began again, with a smile of his own which failed to reach his cold eyes.
"Why don't we dispense with the pleasantries and get to why I'm really here today, shall we?"
The mistress of the Winged Hussars had never had dealings with the Scorpions, but, like any other business enterprise, it was good practice to do research on potential adversaries, and it appeared at least one of the things she had learned about Alastair Sinclair was on the mark. He had no time for BS. For the first time, a real smile creased Alexis's lips. I need you to find something for me.
Alastair raised one quizzical eyebrow as he felt the growing tug of intrigue.
We will keep up our part of the deal, Alexis. I will track down the power sources Jim Cartwright needs for his army of Ragnar.
I have a little side project in mind, said Alexis. I need you to find something.
Alexis could see Alastair's intrigue transform into open-mouthed surprise as she added,
and then steal it.
She wants us to do what?
Exclaimed Jamie Sinclair. His face flushed as red as the hair on his head. Jamie's words caused several heads to turn in the direction of the three most senior officers of the Scorpions, clustered around a table in the corner of the mess hall. One look at the stern faces of First Sergeants Ethan Kroll and Isla Stewart, sitting at an adjacent table, ensured those heads invariably found something more interesting to do in a hurry. Alastair Sinclair let out a small sigh as he repeated himself.
For those of us who are obviously hard of hearing or were not listening the first time, we are going to locate and steal an unknown number of Ragnar and experimental guild power sources, which, if the rumors are true, will allow them to fight at their full potential for an unlimited time.
This is a joke, right? Asked Tim Buchanan from the seat beside the younger Sinclair. A trace of a grin hidden quickly by a raised coffee mug only added to Jamie Sinclair's consternation and, Tim noticed, Alastair's amusement. Alastair eyed his youngest son through the steam rising from his coffee. Jamie had inherited his mother's quick temper, which, in his childhood, had led to many a bruising confrontation with his elder brother, Charles. In his teens, his temper had seen him suffer more bruising, though this time, it had been at the hands of experienced mercs employed by Alastair to train his boys for their future careers in the Scorpions. Slowly but surely, Jamie learned to curb his rush to anger. Instead, he let the more logical and calmer side of his brain guide him. Even so, every now and then something would prick him just the wrong way, and, in a flash, traits of his mother would surface. Alastair sat back, watching the flash of anger rapidly dissipate as Jamie marshaled his inner zen. The older Sinclair winked conspiratorially at Tim, who raised his own mug in mock salute. An evil smile formed on the lips of Jamie Sinclair as his brain worked the problem.
Oh, yeah. We can do this. It's gonna take a bit of planning and stones the size of a mountain to pull off. But I think we can do this, Jamie said.
That's when Alastair dropped his second bombshell.
Not we, son. You.
Jamie's head flicked sideways from his father to Tim, and back to his father in confusion. Alastair put down his coffee, resting his elbows on the table, and pointed one large, fat finger at Jamie as he spoke.
You are to take Zulu Company, and secure as many Ragnar as you can. Alexis Cromwell has assured me you have the entire resources of not only the Winged Hussars available to you, but those of Asbaran Solutions and Cartwright's Cavaliers also.
Alastair let out an unexpected chuckle.
Not that you're going to need them. Cartwright, Shirazi, Cromwell, and Erilk seem to think that the answer to any problem is to fling shitloads of firepower at it. We know better. Non vi sed arte, said Tim proudly. Not by strength, by guile,
Jamie interpreted the Latin motto of the Scorpions.
Meanwhile, said Alastair, I and my trusty sidekick here.
A casual nod indicated he meant Tim.
We'll track down these experimental guild power sources.
Tim's lips thinned as he chewed on his lower lip for a moment, before clicking his fingers as a thought came to him.
You know, Colonel, If there is anybody able to give us the lowdown on a guild site they are trying to keep below the radar, it's Dieral.
That underhanded piece of Kyrex turd! He is one flat owl I would never tire of kicking, stated Jamie,
with a face like he had eaten something sour.
Yeah, if the Orta, his tortantula partner, ever let you get that close, joked Alistair.
In all his dealings with Dieral, the diminutive, furry, chipmunk-like Flattar had never once been without his overly aggressive partner. And an angry tortantula was not something you wanted to be near.
True. Dieral is not the most trustworthy of individuals, agreed Tim,
getting the conversation back on track.
But as an information broker, he has never let us down. If the money was right.
Money is not something we have to worry about on this job, replied Alistair,
producing two yaks from his breast pocket and handing one to Jamie, who took a glance at the small Universal Account Access card, the yak, before slipping it into his own pocket.
The four horsemen have been good enough to give us an open-ended line of credit.
Jamie let out a low whistle.
Wow. When you said money was no object, you meant it.
And you're going to need it, son. Aunt Kate and the Salamanca will take you as far as Wayland Station in the Centaur region. But from there, you're on your own.
What about us? Asked Tim.
Alexis Cromwell has kindly lent us a frigate, the EMS Glambering, which, Alexis assures me, has a solid captain and crew. And before you ask,
Alistair saw the imminent question on Tim's lips,
I will be in command, and you my second.
Tim's closing jaw showed Alistair that he had satisfied the anticipated query. The older Sinclair understood that a clear chain of command was essential, and it was one of the things he had insisted on when Alexis had suggested the Scorpions use one of her ships, rather than a merchantman like the Salamanca. Having said that, Alistair had taken on board one of Alexis's other suggestions, a suggestion which he knew Tim would not be too happy about.
I also need you to select a trooper for a close protection position, said Alistair.
Tim didn't hesitate.
Corporal Vega. Solid, dependable, thinks on his feet, and damn good in a fight.
In his head, the face of the man who had sat in his office not so many days ago came to Alistair. Corporal Johnny Vega had been with Tim on the initial contract to Galax, so Tim had first-hand experience with his skills as a merc, but also of another factor crucial to a good close protection post. The ability to be affable with your client while standing your ground when called for. If Tim was happy Vega was the man for the job, then Vega it was.
Why do we need a CP trooper? Asked Tim wearily.
A large, toothy grin split Alistair's face.
Did I forget to mention we are taking a civilian expert with us?
Tim's protest was cut short as Alistair stood, and Tim and Jamie sprang to their feet. The meeting was over. They had their orders.
We ship out at 0600 hours tomorrow, so I shan't delay you any further. I'm sure you both have lots to be taken care of.
In unison, Tim and Jamie braced to attention with a simple,
Sir!
Before spinning about and heading for the mess hall exit. As they passed Kroll and Stewart, the first sergeant slipped into step one pace behind. Alistair watched them go before retaking his seat. Cradling his still hot coffee, he closed his eyes and, to the casual observer, appeared to be a man marshalling his thoughts. In truth, he was constructing a third set of orders for transmission via his pin plants to Kate Priceman. He had plans for her on the Salamanca, once they had completed their task of transporting Jamie and Zulu Company to Wayland Station.
Chapter 7
Let's get this show on the road. Alistair Sinclair stepped gingerly from the travelator, which had carried him to one of the seemingly endless number of docking berths along the outer skin of Prime Base. Although this berth was in what should have been one of the quieter areas of Prime Base, there was a steady flow of Winged Hussars personnel and equipment moving purposefully between the various docks. Through the throng, Alistair caught sight of the tan, scorpion uniform of Tim Buchanan, waiting impatiently for him alongside the access doors leading to the berth where his new ship awaited. The Salamanca had departed for Whalen Station 2 hours earlier, carrying Jamie Sinclair and the troopers of Zulu Company on their strand of the mission. And Alistair staunchly refused to linger on the thought that he had sent his youngest son into harm's way without knowing the fate of his eldest, Charlie. Both men were experienced commanders, fully capable of looking after themselves.
"Glad you could make it," said Tim,
failing to notice his colonel's attention lay elsewhere.
"Things have gotten very busy around here, and Captain Cthu is eager to get underway."
"Well, let's go take a look at this ship Commander Cromwell has graciously allowed us to borrow."
"I think you will be suitably impressed," replied Tim, as an impish smile played upon his lips.
Forestalling anything Alistair may have been about to say, Tim turned, tapping the berth access controls. Motors whined as the heavy doors split and retracted into walls. With a grand sweeping gesture of one arm, Tim bade Alistair enter the berth. With a half-joking scowl, Alistair strode past his friend, wishing he would sometimes take things seriously. All thoughts of reprimanding Tim disappeared as Alistair set eyes upon EMS Glambring for the first time. Coming to a halt, Alistair allowed his eyes to trace the superstructure of the Legend-class escort frigate. The ship's specs that the Scorpion's commander had reviewed in his office the day before did not do the sleek warship justice. 96 meters long, its dual fusion torches could push the Glambring along at a maximum 15 Gs. Her primary weapons were 3 100-megawatt lasers oriented for forward or rear fire primarily, along with a single forward missile tube and a multi-phase shield array. In anybody's book, the Glambring was a force to be reckoned with.
"Not too scrappy, eh, Colonel?" said Tim,
bringing Alistair back to the world.
"Are our people aboard yet?"
asked Alistair.
"Aboard and settling in. The Hussar Marine Complement were none too happy about being kicked off to make room for us. But I understand they cheered up when they were told Commander Cromwell had assigned them to her own ship for the operation at Karma."
Alistair caught sight of a small knot of people gathering around the Glambring's forward personnel lock.
"Looks like my reception committee. Shall we?"
Flanked by Tim, Alistair headed in the group's direction. As he got closer, he recognized the large frame of Corporal Johnny Vega standing at parade rest, apparently completely at ease with his surroundings. Alistair knew better. The corporal wore tan-colored ballistic body armor, the match of his Scorpion's uniform, and an ugly black PS6 people stopper, which sat in its holster at his waist. Alistair gave Vega an approving nod as he stopped in front of the group.
"Colonel Sinclair," said Tim formally, "this is Captain Cthu, commander of EMS Glambring."
The El Shah captain may only have been 90 centimeters tall, but he oozed command confidence. Having graduated from the Hussars Naval Warfare College, Alistair reminded himself that the diminutive El Shah had earned his current position.
"Captain," said Alistair respectfully, "I look forward to working with you."
"And I you, Colonel."
The reptile-like El Shah cocked his head, as if to ascertain Alistair's ilk, and after a few seconds, the small head returned to vertical.
Commander Cromwell speaks highly of you. My ship and its crew are at your disposal. Where you lead, I shall follow.
Alistair's lips formed a thin smile. The Elsha captain had, in one eloquent sentence, neatly sidestepped any issue of who was in command of this mission, making what could have been a thorny problem disappear before it even arose. Switching his attention to the next person in the small reception party, Alistair found himself confronted by an outstretched hand, which he automatically grasped and shook. The owner of the hand smiled a blinding smile at him, while a pair of jade-green eyes, which seemed to sparkle playfully, captivated his full attention. Alistair shook himself mentally, tearing his gaze away from the hypnotizing eyes to assess their owner properly. Before him stood a human female of obvious East Asian extraction. Slight of frame, though you would never have guessed it by the way she had returned Alistair's strong handshake with one of her own, and jet-black hair pulled back from her face and tied in a bun. She wore a jacket and pants, with more pockets than Alistair could count, colored the same green as her intense eyes. Tim leaned in, mouth beginning to form words, only to be cut off by the petite woman.
"I am fully capable of remembering my own name tag, thank you, Captain."
The woman's eyes searched his uniform until they alighted on Tim's name tag.
"Buchanan?"
Tim's mouth closed with an audible click, and Alistair fought hard to suppress a laugh, which he converted to a cough into his hand, while giving Tim, whose cheeks had begun to flush red, a knowing glance.
"Dr. Anna May Wong,"
the woman said, introducing herself while blatantly ignoring Tim.
"Nice to meet you, Ms. Wong."
"Dr. Wong, Colonel. I hold doctorates in a half-dozen fields of physics, energy generation, and engineering. In fact,"
she thumbed in the direction of the warship behind her,
"the Glambring has my latest design powering her."
Anna plowed on with barely a breath.
"And this is my assistant, Engineer Laris."
Beside Anna, a 4-foot-long millipede reared up, its elongated, flattened segments bent smoothly, and its front legs clicked together in welcome, as the Jiha gave Alistair a short, curt bow, which Alistair returned. Satisfied, the Jiha lowered itself until all of its feet were back on deck. A fleeting thought passed through Alistair's mind.
"A good thing you're on board. We're going to need all the engineering skills available where we're going."
In fact, Dr. Wong and her Jiha assistant were crucial to the success of the mission, hence the presence of the heavily armed Corporal Vega. Speaking of which,
"Perhaps, Captain Buchanan, you would like to explain Corporal Vega's presence here."
Alistair couldn't help but notice Dr. Wong's wary look in the direction of the Scorpion trooper. Tim didn't miss it either, and grasped his opportunity to needle the doctor.
"Of course, sir. As Dr. Wong so eloquently explained, she is an expert in all things power plant, and our mission is to secure energy sources capable of powering Ragnar. Therefore, it seems only prudent to ensure her safety."
Tim gestured toward the trooper.
"Hence, Corporal Vega here will become your constant shadow. Everywhere you go, he will go."
"Now just one damn second,"
blustered Anna.
"No way am I having some over-muscled, thick-skulled gorilla."
Alistair held up an open-palmed hand and cut Anna's furor off in mid-sentence.
"Corporal Vega's presence, Dr. Wong, is non-negotiable. No Corporal Vega, no Dr. Wong on this mission."
Anna took a calming breath while wringing her hands in front of her. After a few moments, she loudly exhaled, and her features returned to their previous state of calm. Gracing Alistair with a blinding smile, she said,
"Your wish is my command, Colonel."
Turning to Vega, she playfully slapped his arm, saying,
"Let's go, King Kong."
And with that, she headed up the ramp into the Glambring.